This is The Impromptu, a multifaceted show discussing how technology, art, design, and equality converge on topics that matter most to us. From gaming culture to film and other forms of media, we examine the creative process and how the decisions we make shape our perceptions and lives. And now, your hosts for today, Michael Norton and Alex Knight.
Something I've been giving a lot of thought to lately is how video games have increasingly become more simplistic and more appealing to a wider spectrum of gamers in terms of their technical abilities. Because you remember a few episodes back, we were talking a little bit about Castlevania and its the Symphony of the Night and its spiritual successor that's being funded on Kickstarter, right? And ended up picking that game up last night, and I've never played it. Miraculously, I've completely forgotten about how unforgiving games used to be 15, 20 years ago because of the infrequent number of save points that you have access to and just the sheer level of difficulty required to do certain things in the games. There's really no hand-holding. Like, in Castlevania Symphony of the Night, they just kind of throw you into it. And I don't know if that's just because that's how all the Castlevania games are, or is it because they assume that you've played previous Castlevania games. I mean, you do get a tiny little bit of backstory at the beginning that more or less gives you just enough information for it to make sense as far as what you're supposed to be doing with, you know, with the protagonist, which is Alucard. I don't really know what the deal is. Maybe you can speak to that. But yeah, I've just been thinking a lot about that stuff lately, about how just games in general, you know, walk you through things. They explain the game mechanics. They give you, they sort of trickle a little bit of information as you need to know it. They don't give it to you all at once. And games really didn't used to be like that. They kind of just threw you in the world, you know, be it intentional because of that's how the game designers wanted it, or maybe, and partially because of technical or technological restrictions or things that basically impeded the ability to put a lot of stuff in the game to make it, I guess, more robust and make it, I don't know, kind of make more sense.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a mix of both. Technologically, a lot of the features that have come over the years, they didn't exist until somebody created them, like the ability to save your game. That was unheard of until they invented it for Legend of Zelda. So until then, every game was, you die, game over, that's it. But then they said, well, hey, now we have enough memory to actually store the game state. Now we can actually save data. And so then that evolved and evolved with increasing amounts of storage and memory. We're able to store a more complex array of game state data, to the point where you now have automatic checkpoints and manual saves and all these other things that would have been completely unheard of to somebody playing the original console games. Like, if you went back in time to the 80s and told someone, oh, hey, you know that Mario game you're playing? Or actually, no, it would have been before that. You know that Centipede game you're playing? Imagine if you could save it right at any possible second, just before you die or whenever. They would look at you like you were insane. So there's that side of things. But then there's also kind of, actually, I don't know. I think a lot of it might really be technological.
But I mean, just beyond that, I mean, a lot of modern games will have, for example, checkpoints, and they do their best to not allow the player to get lost in the gameplay. For example, you can't just do anything you want in most games unless it's an open world concept, which is a whole nother thing. So you know, it's very structured. It's, you know, go to this checkpoint and do X to in order to progress to the next point. You know, for example, recently I was playing Life is Strange Episode 3, and it's structured in a way that, you know, you can't just do whatever you want. You can't just go anywhere in the city. You have to go to through specific checkpoints in order to progress in the game. Whereas in something like Castlevania Symphony of the Night, you have exploration as like the primary focus in that game. And, you know, I read a piece in On Boing Boing about that game by Lee Alexander about how you can play that game many times over and still uncover new things. You can still uncover new loot. You can uncover rooms that you thought you discovered, but you know you didn't. So stuff like that, you don't really see a lot of that now, unless it's a game that is specifically done in a retro sort of throwback way to those types of games. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I was kind of thinking about that. That is also kind of a technological thing, because what I was going to say was game designers often have these visions for things. They often imagine what their game could be like, and they imagine new ways of gameplay, but then they take that to the engineers and they go, hey, can we do this? And the engineers say, nope.
Right, but I mean, again, going back to the example of Symphony of the Night, I'm sure even back then when that game was released, they could have done something as simple as on the map, which they provide you, it shows you the areas you've discovered, right? And it doesn't show you areas that you haven't discovered, which is not entirely a new thing. I mean, that's been around in a lot of games. However, a lot of games now, if they provide the user a map to that level, they'll at least provide a checkpoint, you know, a little bubble that says, this is where you're going. I mean, you're free to explore, but this is where you're going, just so you know. Castlevania, you don't get that. You have no idea. I could stand there for 30 minutes and the game would just let me stand there and be completely lost in the game. And seems intentional to me.
Sure, because it is. The point of Castlevania is to explore the castle. Every area is huge. There are secret rooms. There's all kinds of stuff. And to kind of hold your hand through that and be like, here's where all the stuff is, it would kind of detract from that intended experience. I mean, objective markers, certainly. There have been Metroidvania games that have done that in the recent past, and they've still retained that kind of exploration thing. Like even the Metroid Prime games, for example. It was a 3D Metroidvania game, but they had the map, a lot of it unexplored. They would tell you, oh, you have to go all the way over here to get to this thing that the sensors have detected, but they wouldn't show you the map between where you are and where you need to go. So you would have to figure out how to get to where you're supposed to go. And I mean, that in and of itself is kind of a separate style of game design. But it really depends, because you don't know what the technical limitations were. Like, it could very well have been like, oh, we'd like to include this, but if we include this, then the crazy, insane cathedral level with all the stained glass can't go in because there's not enough memory. Like, everything's a trade-off, especially back then.
I was just going to say, this is a PlayStation 1 game, right? So the memory restrictions alone and the buffers that are available for what you can store for textures and whatnot were so limited for that time. However, one thing I want to explore is how did we get from games like Symphony of the Night, which is what, a 15-year-old game, to the games of today? There's been a progression towards games that hold your hand a little bit more and give you very clear goals and make it very difficult to get lost in the game. And I'm not entirely sure how that sort of design shift happened, because it feels overnight, but when I look at it, clearly it hasn't. And I haven't really noticed it because I've been playing games for so long on such a regular basis that it just kind of, it all blurs together. You don't really notice it until you've actually kind of just sit back and look at things objectively. I mean, I expect the art form of game making to evolve. Do you think it's a bad thing? What are your thoughts? Like, do you think it's a bad thing that games now kind of just really make it so much easier to get through?
I don't think it's a bad thing necessarily. I think it depends on the type of game you're trying to make ultimately. Like Dishonored, for example. You're making a game about an assassin who needs to kill his target. So it gives you the target, it shows you where the target is, it gives you certain abilities and skills you need to complete your mission, and it sets you at your goal. And then you know where you're supposed to go. And it's not an open world game. It's just a level and that's it. It's basically up to you to find your way. But even then, it's like they've kind of gated it because it's just one map with a defined ending where you get to your target and either kill them or use the non-lethal means of getting rid of them. I think it's partially social and partially technological, because due to the increased memory and the increased bandwidth and the processing power, it's possible to create emergent gameplay. Before, you couldn't have done stuff like that. Like, you couldn't have built advanced AI in a game. You couldn't have built decision trees and algorithms that determined what would happen in the game world. None of that stuff would have been possible. So then, all of a sudden, developers have all this power, and then it's like, well, now we can kind of do whatever we want, but what do we want? So then you started to see the open world games, and the open world games had a giant map, so they gave you a detailed map with stuff on it for you to go do. And on that map, it would have, hey, go over here to your next objective. And it could be like a mile away or whatever. But they made it very clear, A to B to C to D, to continue the story. Of course, you can at any time drive off or fly away or do whatever and go do something else. But because of that huge technological leap, suddenly they were able to do these things that required kind of thinking, well, if we're making games this big and crazy, we can't just give the player nothing. Imagine Grand Theft Auto 3 or 4. It just plops you in the middle of the city and it doesn't tell you where to go or what to do or who to talk to. You're supposed to know that you have to drive over here and talk to this random guy to start the next story mission. You would never find it. I think it's kind of a response to the increasing complexity of games. They've become so big, you need gameplay scaffolding that keeps it simple for the gamer.
Okay, I think I feel like you're onto something. Have you played Batman Arkham City?
Yep.
So you know, you're well aware of how large that kind of open world is, right?
Arkham Knight is even bigger. It's crazy.
I think that's an excellent point that you brought up, because can you imagine a game like Arkham City or Arkham Knight with zero guidance? It would be...
You could never beat the game.
Yeah, it would just be... Maybe not impossible, but it would be just so impenetrable that you would just give up on the game.
It would be days of old school, like sitting on GameFAQs or something, waiting for somebody to post some random clue about some mission thread. Oh, hey, I found this thing way over here in this place. And then you'd have people like sketching out maps of everything.
Well, and even too, like, and just in terms of, it's funny, we're talking about the size of games too, both in the world, but like the actual physical size of the compiled game too. If, like, I was just looking at Symphony of the Night, and you know, that download is a couple hundred megabytes only, right? Whereas in comparison now, the average game is, you know, it's not unheard of for a game to be 40 or 50 gigabytes. I mean, just think about that leap from 200 or 300 megabytes to 50 gigabytes, and it's just, it's insane. Like, you, if you were to look at that 15 years ago, it would seem like that's so far out there that you wouldn't even be able to believe that a game could be that big. Like, how could a game be bigger than an operating system?
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, they are. Like, Witcher 3, untold gigabytes. Like, it's at least 40, and then there's the DLC, the upcoming expansions that add 30 or 40 more hours to the game. Each expansion they've announced is an entire new area to explore.
I have not played that game, but that sounds incredible.
CD Projekt Red is like probably the most insane game development studio on the planet right now. Like, where everyone else is kind of half-assing it lately, they do it right. Like, they launch and they're like, hey, have a couple months worth of free DLC, then the first expansion will come out, then we'll have more free DLC, then the second expansion will come out. All the DLC so far has been absolutely free. And then when they launched, no major huge problems except some weird edge case bugs that have popped up that they've since fixed. Like, they've been really, really on top of patching. Like, we're on...
I've noticed that they've done, what, 3 or 4 patches now?
Yeah, and they've been huge patches. Like, they haven't just...
Multiple gigabytes, oh, yeah, for sure.
The last one, 1.07, was 6 gigs. They fixed everything, like a bunch of bugs with quests, to adding an alternate movement. When you enable this option, it decreases the turning circle for Geralt. The default, he kind of has this really wide turning circle that some players have found annoying. So they went in and created a whole new turning circle for him that you can enable or disable at a whim.
Now that's really listening to user feedback and implementing a change like that. That's pretty substantial. That's definitely impressive. That does not happen that often with game developers.
The way they're handling patches, to me, is the way every game studio should handle patches for games. Like, this whole nonsense of, oh, we'll ship the game broken and then we'll have day one patch that'll fix all the problems is ridiculous. And then they'll do maybe one or two more and then forget about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's insulting when you spend a lot of money on a game, like we're talking $50-$60 now for console games, right? And they've been, the price of games today have pretty much stayed at a constant over the last 15 years, I would say. Like, I remember even back in high school, like, a PC or console game, for example, like, okay, like let's say a PlayStation 2 game, right? Brand new retail game. They were $60. So the price of games haven't really changed all that much. And to me, it's an insult as somebody who has given you that much money for a product to have it completely, or not necessarily completely broken, but so buggy where it's now impeding my enjoyment and it's breaking the immersion of me being in that world that you've created for me. To me, it's like, imagine if you were, you bought a novel and 2 or 3 chapters in, there's just like paragraphs of text missing in the middle. Well, what am I going to do with that? Like, if you can get stuck in a game because of a bug in your game engine, that is something that should be caught in QA. That is why you have a QA team, and that's why you do user testing. And I think a lot of companies today still don't do enough user testing. And there's really no excuse for that. You know, it doesn't cost you to do user testing. In fact, it costs you more when you ship that product to consumers' hands and suddenly they're incredibly frustrated. Now with social media, I mean, things spread like wildfire. You do not want unhappy customers filling your Facebook and Twitter accounts with negative feedback.
I think the sad truth is that oftentimes QA kind of gets pushed back till the end of the project when the budget has started to run out.
See, that is fundamentally a flawed way of doing it.
Oh, it is. It absolutely is.
And I was actually reading, I'm not finished it yet, but I've been reading the Skunkworks book by Ben Rich, who worked on that whole project famously. One of the fascinating things to me about how that stealth bomber was made is one of the things that they did during the manufacturing, or even the actual process of building that thing, is that one of the advantages they had is they made QA an integral part of the design process. QA was done every step of the way to maintain a precise level of quality. And even Ben Rich said in the book, he's like, a lot of our competitors make the mistake of just tacking the QA stuff at the end. They say, we'll design the product, we'll build it, we'll do prototypes, but then they do the QA stuff at the end and stuff slips through. Now, I mean, granted, things need to be mission critical for an object like a plane, but I would argue that there's no reason why you cannot apply that concept to software development. Software, I'll just use software development as a blanket term, meaning it doesn't matter if any piece of software, whether it's a game or an app or a service that somebody's using, QA should be throughout the entire development process, because you'll end up with a tighter product in the end.
Yeah. I mean, you're preaching to the choir. I just think it's like, to them, especially at this point, like, it's become kind of this habit, because patching exists, they kind of have this mentality of, well, we'll focus all of our budget on making the game and adding all this crazy stuff. And then that allows them to do things like feature creep, and we'll just like add on all of these things. We'll add multiplayer, we'll add DLC, we'll do whatever, no big deal. And then you're 2 months from shipping, probably not 2 months, maybe I'll be a little generous, maybe three and a half months from shipping. And then it's like, well, we're down to 20% of our budget and we need to start on the QA. Oh, well, and then marketing chimes in with, well, we really should add this in. And then that goes in first because marketing takes priority. And then by the time you've done QA, this is the other crazy thing, because games have become so much more complex and so huge, the amount of time it takes to test them has exponentially increased. And in fact, there are parts of games that might be impossible to test in QA, given the time commitment required. Like, take Witcher 3. How long would it take for a team of QA testers to run through every square inch of that world? Do every single quest.
Well, this is why you need playtesting, right? Because you can't expect your entire staff to be doing that.
No. And
I mean, you can try and do as much as you can, but that's why you need to enlist other people to help you with that.
Sure, but at the end of the day, you've got a ship date that you have to hit, and playtesters, that's part of the budget. You can't find people that'll do this for free. Playtesting is hard. Long hours. As far as I know, you don't get paid a lot.
It's not particularly fun because you're constantly running into issues.
You have to play over and over again. So then it's like, first you have QA. That's like the first line of defense against super critical, obvious bugs. But then you try to hire playtesters, and depending on how big the game is, like for a game like Witcher 3, you would need a small army of playtesters to even make a dent in that content to find things. And so by the time they even get to this part, it's like, well, we only have enough money to hire this many and have QA work on it for this many hours. So then that happens, and management will just kind of go, oh yeah, okay, sure. And then they'll ship it, and then maybe they'll continue doing QA, which is where the zero-day patch comes from. Then it ships, then the complaints start rolling in, then they get to patch 2, and that's it. They'll basically keep fixing a game until people stop complaining, and then they'll figure, oh, it's fine.
If we could for a moment, I kind of want to circle back to the beginning of the conversation, because I was just thinking recently about games like Bloodborne, for example, which personally I haven't played, but I know enough about it And I know enough of the backlash from certain people that I guess certain people feel that certain types of gamers, let's say, feel that games have been watered down too much, that games help you too much, and the general experience isn't as challenging as it maybe could be or should be, according to a lot of these people. Now, mind you, I don't agree with their mindset specifically, because there seems to be a lot of elitist attitudes. You know, most games today are quote unquote made for children, and that if you're, you know, a real gamer and an adult, you'll want to play games like Bloodborne, for example. Personally, I think that there's nothing wrong with games like Bloodborne, you know, and I'm all for, and I really do think that there should be more innovation in the game space as far as more rich, immersive stories with characters and situations that evoke deep emotional responses. I don't think there's enough of that. However, I do believe that there is a place for games like Bloodborne, for games like any kind of spiritual successor to Castlevania Symphony of the Night. I think they can exist. And so I don't agree with the arguments on both sides. On the one hand, I see elitist gamers saying that anything that is not like Bloodborne is basically a child's game and they're crap. And then on the other hand, you got people that are saying, we need more innovation in the gaming industry. We need games that evoke more deep emotional responses. And that most of the stuff that's made today is just a rehash of the same old IP over and over and over, which is somewhat true as well. So I just feel like it's too much one way or the other. And I really feel like we should try to come to somewhere in the middle and just say, look, both can exist. We need both.
We absolutely need both. And in fact, like, I think a lot of the movement towards, well, there's a lot of games that are all about killing things is totally spot on. Like, okay, sure, we can have games about shooting things and whatever. Like, that, we can still have that. But let's have some games that explore other things. Like, we have all of this raw processing power, so why don't we create totally new types of games? Like Gone Home, or their upcoming, their next project, Tacoma, which looks amazing. It was just featured in Game Informer. It's definitely a lot more complicated than Gone Home, but it still has that kind of nonviolent yet inquisitive. You end up in this setting, and something strange is going on. And you kind of want to explore and find out what happened or why things are the way they are. I feel like Gone Home and Tacoma are like this very specific subgenre of adventure game. That's a totally new type of game that exists and that people have loved. And then there can totally be tons of other kinds of games, like Mirror's Edge, for example. The first one, there were still some guns in it, but overall, the point was to run through a bunch of obstacles, parts of buildings, avoid guards, that sort of thing.
But it was the guards that had the guns, right?
You could take a gun from them, but you didn't have to. But apparently in the new one that EA is making, the reboot, you won't be able to pick up any guns.
Oh, so this is a reboot, not a sequel.
Yeah, they've decided to kind of start over.
It's a odd choice to me. Because I felt like they were just kind of explaining that world. And in fact, actually, I didn't even really feel that game needed a sequel. Like, I was fine with it, that ending. I'm like, okay, I know who these characters are. I've been through their journey. I get how it ends. Like, okay, do I really need a sequel? Like, I wasn't yearning. I must know more about these characters. I mean, I cared for the character, the protagonist, but I didn't have that strong yearning to want to see more.
That's the other thing. It's like a lot of this original IP, it's like they kind of create this self-contained story and then you don't really feel like another one is necessary. Like The Last of Us, for example, that was a perfect story start to finish. Do we really need a sequel? Probably not. Like, their story is over as far as I'm concerned. So if they did another game, I would have to assume that it would be about different characters in the same universe.
I actually would want to see another game if it was Ellie. I really want to see more of Ellie.
Yeah, I mean, you do, and yet at the same time, it would kind of cheapen the whole thing, I think. I feel like this is kind of the trap we fall into. It's like we always go, oh, we'd love to see more original content, but then at the same time we go, oh man, that was awesome. I want more of that. You know, which is it, right? People want both, and unfortunately there isn't enough money in a game studio's pockets for both. Not when every game is a multi-million dollar commitment. It's like, well, we can either make Call of Duty 47, which we know people will buy millions of copies of.
It's a cash cow. It's like Microsoft Office, right? We're always going to have a Microsoft Office. We're always going to have a Call of Duty or a Battlefield.
So then it's like, well, we can take a chance on this original IP and hope people like it. But then if nobody buys it, we'll have lost all that money. And that's a whole other thing. That's a huge problem in and of itself.
I understand why companies, big companies specifically, are risk averse with IPs, because it absolutely could be a big financial risk. And when you're in a position where people know you've produced, like you said, Call of Duty 47, you know, it's something people trust. It's something they feel comfortable with. It's an old pair of shoes that they can slip into and, you know, just, that, yeah, I know what this is. I know what this feeling is. Feels good. But yet it also feels slightly new. And that's boring to some people. I get that. But, you know, and on the other hand, I really do feel that in the future, we're going to see more of these game developers who have worked on these big projects go indie. I think they'll use platforms like Kickstarter. We're already starting to see that happen. I think we're going to see more and more of that. I can't say, you know, for certain if that's something that's going to be like the prevalent way of developing games in the future. It very well could be. But I really do think like over the next couple of years, more and more of that stuff is going to happen. And who knows, maybe one day that will be a large portion of how games get made. And I think that actually could be a good thing. Because we would get games that are interesting and, you know, things we want to see that we know a company, for example, like EB or maybe Activision or Ubisoft, they wouldn't necessarily go down that route.
I think we've started to see some larger studios take more chances. A Mirror's Edge reboot, you would totally never have guessed that would happen in a million years.
No, I mean, I would think the sort of de facto thing to do would have been naturally a sequel, right? That's what everyone probably would have expected.
I don't even know if a sequel would have been expected. It didn't exactly do super well financially. I'm not sure the exact numbers, but I know they weren't happy with it. The fact that they would actually do anything with it again is surprising. It kind of shows that momentum towards, well, you know what? Let's try this, because there's been a bunch of original content over the past few years that's kind of been proof that, hey, this works. People like this. Like The Last of Us. Naughty Dog, it was all like Uncharted 1, Uncharted 2, Uncharted 3. Everyone's like, whoa, Uncharted. This is great. And then all of a sudden, oh, hey, guys, zombie apocalypse. Out of left field, out of nowhere. And it was amazing. I think it won every single game award that year.
Are you talking about The Last of Us?
Yeah.
Well, I would, rightfully so. I think that game is a pure joy to play. I think it absolutely deserves any awards that it got. I think the voice acting is spectacular. The game looks fantastic on the PS4. The soundtrack is phenomenal. The score is just unbelievable. I cared about a lot of the characters in that game. I was really invested in it from start to finish. So I wish we had more games like that. I'm not talking about zombie survival games. I'm just talking about games of that kind of caliber. But of course, they cost millions to make. Multiple millions.
Luckily, with Naughty Dog, they can just say, hey, Sony, we'd like to make a game about space giraffes. And then Sony goes, how much money do you want?
Naughty Dog strikes me as the kind of company that they've gotten to this level now where they're big, but I still feel like they're doing interesting things that maybe we could see something that will kind of make us sit back and kind of be surprised that they would do some things like that. Like a new take on something. It doesn't have to be... And when I say game innovation, and we talk about that innovation word gets thrown around a lot, and I don't think innovation necessarily means something so completely out of left field that you'd never ever see it coming. I think there's lots of little things that could be done. And I mean, I think you could say that for any type of product that you develop, whether it's a piece of software or a game, something that, you know, people are playing. You know, innovation to me is more incremental. And yes, over time, you know, year after year, you may not really be fully cognizant of all the little innovations that are going into the product that you're using, but it's there.
Absolutely. Like, you look at a game like Middle-earth Shadow of Mordor, the AI in that, the Nemesis system, totally crazy. And now that that's possible, imagine what games coming out in the next few years are going to do now that AI like that can be written.
Perfect example of something that is absolutely limited and bound by the hardware that it's on. You could never do that on a PS3 or any last-gen console, really.
No, they actually had to dumb it down. They didn't even have the Nemesis system on those old consoles, basically. They had something like it, but it wasn't anywhere near the same thing.
Do you think that, in terms of just staying on the topic of gaming, do you think that hardware drives the software, or do you think it's the reverse of that? That software, that really what you want to do in your games is driving the direction of the hardware?
I think it can kind of be a tug of war with that, but currently it's the software informing the hardware. Because at the E3 where they announced the new consoles, all you heard from the system architects was, we went to developers and we asked them, and this is what we built as a result. Like, that was kind of the mission statement for the PS4. And I think the Xbox One. I paid more attention to the Sony briefing. That seemed to be kind of the general sense. And also the reason why they were moving to x86. So that, hey, you develop on a PC, now the consoles are PCs. So it's way easier to actually build something because the chip in your PC is the same architecture as the chip in the console. So it makes it that much easier to design for it.
I wish I knew enough about game development that I could comment on that stuff. Like, I'm very curious about the Unreal Engine. If you're using that on a Windows box, in terms of like, how would you compile that so that it works on a PS4? Like, what kind of voodoo do you have to do to get it working now?
I think it's a little different with that, because with Windows and Xbox One, you've got DirectX, which is a totally different architecture. I would assume that the PS4 is using OpenGL. There are a lot of middleware libraries that allow you to kind of port code between them, but, or actually, No.
Don't you have to have, I mean, not just necessarily for the PlayStation, but don't you actually have to get a special developer version of the console in order to develop for it?
Yeah, you do.
I think it's always been like that with consoles, right?
Yeah, although...
Because they go up on eBay. Like, I was just watching a video about the Sega Saturn and stuff like that, and you can find all sorts of, like, early development console versions that look nothing like the consumer variant.
Oh, the old ones, yeah. I'm sure you can pick up old ones.
They basically look like beige PC boxes. Like, they're just like generic parts thrown in a box. That's your development box.
Yeah, those are kind of crazy. Of course, all the recent ones, you're totally not allowed to give those out under pain of death and death of 1,000 lawsuits.
Worse than death, Sony will just make you disappear. It's like you were never born. You never existed.
Same thing as what Konami's doing with Kojima.
Oh, God. Let's not go into that again.
Kojima Productions, what's that? No, Metal Gear Solid 5 is a Konami game. Now that it's all kind of PC, it's in theory a lot easier. Plus, a lot of the core architecture can be the same. To clarify from my earlier statement, DirectX and OpenGL are just like rendering pipelines. They do use slightly different APIs, but you can kind of get around that with some middleware. It's not like a huge insurmountable thing. You do retain like the bulk of your code between versions. They do essentially have to be like two different executables. Like you basically have to compile the game for PS4 and then compile it for Xbox One, because it's like two separate paths. They're not the same thing, so they have to be slightly different in places. It's nowhere near as insane as it used to be, because before this gen, everything was wildly different. You had PowerPC or some weird custom chip, and not only a weird custom chip, but a weird custom chip combined with a conventional ATI or NVIDIA graphics card, which made it even weirder. Overall, it's become a lot easier than it was, which is great for developers.
What about the resurgence of retro video games? Games that are made now, but hark back to a time of perhaps 8-bit or even 16-bit graphics. I'm unsure of how this whole thing happened, and it's not a good or a bad thing necessarily. I just think it's interesting because I look back on it, it just seems like, you know, a couple of years ago they started slowly coming out, and now they're just coming out of the woodwork. I'm not entirely clear on what spurred that sudden development.
It's probably all nostalgia, but also I think a love of 8-bit has kind of always been there. A lot of the time people do chiptune, so that's kind of been slowly going along all this time.
Nobody listening knows what chiptune is. What is that?
So chiptune is a genre of music that uses 8-bit synthesizers that they used to use on old video games. So for example, the soundtrack of Scott Pilgrim was partially chiptune, because obviously it had a lot of references to old 8-bit games.
So that's just a blanket sort of term that says music that's made with those old kind of synthesizers.
Yeah, pretty much. And chiptune specifically is like almost exclusively made with those synthesizers. It's usually instrumental 9 times out of 10. And yeah, like people just create these insane symphonies of synth that sound like an old game. And some of them kind of go a bit dubstep as well. That's kind of a subgenre where they add the new synth with the old synth, and then it's just like this insane old console game being set on fire by lasers.
Castlevania Symphony of the Synth. Spiritual successor.
There's kind of always been that undercurrent in society, especially lately. Like, with Ready Player One and a bunch of other stuff, there's kind of been a resurgence of 80s nostalgia, especially.
Kung Fury. Perfect example.
Yes. Exactly. So I feel like there's kind of a demand for something that kind of resembles those old games. In a lot of modern games, they've thrown in Easter eggs to their old games. Like the new Wolfenstein game, there's an Easter egg where you can play the original Wolfenstein game.
I actually found that one. That was really cool.
They wouldn't put it in there if they didn't think people would enjoy it.
I think that's called a Wolfenception.
Yeah, probably. It's all kind of floating around there, so it makes sense that people still want it because the developers are still dishing it out. So yeah, it's. I feel like it's kind of a cyclical thing. People love this stuff, so developers make it, so people love it more, so developers make more of it, and then we end up with full-fledged games that resemble those old style games.
Well, and I think too, with any kind of nostalgia, you know, be it, fashion trends that, have once or have long since been out of fashion and come back again. And, you know, same thing with retro gaming and all that is that I think it's like, you know, it's like a steam locomotive. You know, one or two people do it and eventually it just grows and grows, and there's a snowball effect, and just it keeps picking up steam and picking up steam. And I think that you could maybe say that for a lot of different types of genres and culture in anything that really gets made. I mean, it's practically impossible to pinpoint it to like one specific thing, or, you know, this is the year where this thing happened because of X. You know, it's practically impossible to do that.
It's just kind of a cultural zeitgeisty sort of thing. It's like, this is popular because it's popular. So give the people what they want. And on that note, see you next time. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Impromptu. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to leave a rating on iTunes and let your friends know about us.
Detailed show notes for each episode are available on our website at theimpromptu.net. You can follow the show on Twitter at theimpromptu, as well as our hosts individually at Zen Impulse for Michael Norton and at Zero Distraction for Alex Knight. As we are entirely listener-supported, you can donate to us at theimpromptu.net/donate. All proceeds go towards covering bandwidth as well as equipment upgrades to uphold the highest level of audio quality you've come to expect. We really do appreciate your support, and we look forward to seeing you next time.